Blog Talk Radio.
Right.
Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. I am Sandy Rogers, and it is my honor indeed to be a part, to be a host, to bring you the absolutely world's most experienced experts in their fields. And tonight is no exception. I get excited on Tuesdays because these individuals have agreed and they come willingly and anxiously to present to you, the listening audience, their contributions to the world. So tonight is no different. And I am so excited to bring this young lady to the microphone. But, you know, there's a couple of things that we got to take care of first. And the very first thing that we do is we pay homage to our ancestors. We give thanks. We honor them. We love them. We are indeed touched and fortified by their presence, by their tenacity to stay focused on that which they came to do on this planet Earth. And ancestors, we're just so thankful that you left this place in a better way than what it was when you found it. We also want to acknowledge one of our young women humanitarians, AIDS activist, advocate, Hadeya Broadbent. She actually made her transition last Tuesday on the 20th at a young age of 39, but she came in, she did her work, and I tell you, the work is never done, right? It's always for someone else to pick up and to continue doing the work. And so we just give honor and we ask that the ancestors accept that young soul into the realm so that she also continues doing what she's doing. Hadeya, we send you love and blessings. So, you know, it's all about life. It's all about love. And it's all about wellness. So tonight we're in our part three of a four-part series called I Learned to Walk in the Rain. Our featured expert tonight is Antoinette Jones, who was actually born positive. So we're going to understand from her lens what that's like, the work that she does, and the reason why she does what she does. So before we get to Antoinette, though, because I'm really, really excited. I heard this young lady speak just a couple of weeks ago, and I was so impressed. I was like, oh, yeah, she's going to be on my show. So audience, you know, you're always invited to be a part of the discussion. And our call-in number here is 516-531-9819. And if you so desire to speak live on air, if you have a question for Antoinette, if you want to just congratulate her on the work that she's doing or just make a statement, feel free to do so. And the only thing that I would ask of you, since this is a radio program, a show that people like to call and listen over and over to the interviews, is that once your line is open and you're not speaking, if you would just mute your phone so that any background noises does not disturb the air quality, the playback quality for those that would call back in or will listen to it for the first time. I appreciate that. And if you would like to listen to any of our previous shows, you may do so by going to www.radio.com/Sandy Rogers. And my name is SandyRodgers. We've been at this for 10 years, so there's bound to be some shows, some titles, some of our guests that would pique your interest that you may want to listen to. And again, thank you, thank you, thank you for listening tonight to Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. So we're going to take a quick music break, and we come back. I have the pleasure of bringing to the microphone Antoinette Jones as we listen to the contributions that she's making to humanity, education of all of our people, as we continue this program of I Learn to Walk in the Rain. We'll be right back, you guys.
Pick somebody up.
That's Raul Madonna singing Pick Somebody Up. And as you listen to our guest tonight, you'll understand why I played that to be the background music for her as she comes and talks to us, right? You guys are going to be so amazed with this young lady. Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back to Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. So I'm going to read the write-up that I prepared for tonight's presentation. It's called I Learned to Walk in the Rain, and again, it's featuring, we're featuring Antoinette Jones, who was born HIV positive. So this is part three of a four-part series. Our last session is going to be on March the 12th, where all three of the women will come together in a panel and have a final discussion on HIV women and with girls. So women and HIV AIDS is our focus for these four shows and representing the largest hit population. So we're offering a variety of women and circumstances that can result in someone becoming positively impacted. So tonight we're going to be talking with Antoinette Jones, who was born with an HIV positive diagnosis. Antoinette says she's been living with HIV for 29 years, and that is the only lifestyle she knows. How about that? She has worked herself up through the educational processes and has passed her knowledge on to others, especially the youth and young people. Antoinette has served as a peer specialist and navigator. She's done HIV testing. She studied holistic care and other various care services to be able to the young people she enjoys educating and working with. She is the creator of two organizations. And we're going to ask her the reason why she named her two organizations, what she did. The first one is called the Dandelion Incorporated, and the second organization is the Dandelion Movement, and they assist 35 women. We have our National Women and Girls HIV Awareness Day is coming up on March the 10th. And so we're doing this, these four shows, in order to heighten the awareness of HIV that still plagues our community heavily, and especially the female population. And so before I get going too much in this world, I want to bring to the microphone Ms. Antoinette Jones, and I am so pleased. She has such a vibrant energy about her, and she is a educator. Pardon, man, she's just got it going on. And Antoinette, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Miss Sandy. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yes.
And I just want to start by just saying thank you for honoring Hadia and her legacy the way that you did at the beginning of this call. I will be remiss if I didn't follow along and recognize Hadia for all of the work that she's done in community, for just being a leader for voices of people who were born with HIV like myself. I would mm-hmm. not even be able to speak out or even share my story or even embody other women, people living with HIV, people born with HIV to share their story without first seeing Hadia do it at the age of 5 years old. So thank you so much for just starting us off with that moment to recognize her and her legacy. And as she transitions from this realm to an ancestral realm, we will always honor her and stand on her shoulders. So thank you for that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for saying it. So tell us about Antoinette. Tell us about this life that you're living.
So this life that I'm living is a whirlwind, I would say. I want to start by saying there may be moments where I have to immediately put myself on mute because I am a new mom of a two-year-old. And sometimes it's her show, it's not my show, and I just have to go along with it.
So, yes, ma'am. I fully understand that.
So I might have to mute just to just get her together as far as, like, making sure her show is where it needs to be or, you know, she got all her snacks the way she needs it because she's a princess and she deserves it. So, but, 29 years, I wasn't always this. Thank you for those kind words and that introduction because the me that you see today was not the me that you would probably have seen, I want to say, about 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I'm happy to say that I'm proud of me today. It's an honor to say that. I'm proud of who I am and how I show up. But I don't do this work for myself, community. I do it for the people that I love. I do it to make a difference. And I do it for this baby who, in 20 years from now, her world is not going to look anything like the world that I see today. So I want to make sure that she's impacted differently and educated and knowledgeable about certain things, either related to HIV or anything in the world. So it took a journey, I want to say, to get to this point. It took a lot of prayer, not just for myself, but from my family, from people around me. It took covering. Here you go. You see, she's coming around already.
She's like, look, I'm part of the story, too.
And she is. She is, you know, and I can't hide her or shy her in any way because everybody knows the lyric and they know her to be Antoinette's baby. Who's gonna make her name known? So, but it took a little bit to get to this point. Even just being born with HIV, being adopted at a young age, being someone who has been in foster care not for a very long time, but you know, had that be a part of my story is very important because of how the system is set up in New York. That's where I was born and raised, in the Bronx, New York. So shout out to all the New Yorkers out there. I also recognize, like, that's where I received some of the best care in New York. They just knew what they were doing when it came to my care and caring for children born with HIV. I think it also took a lot of patience from my parents, my mom, especially my adopted mom, but she is my mom, because I just couldn't imagine what it was like to, you know, see this diagnosis of just this little tiny baby and have to, at the time, not have a lot of research, not have a lot of information on how to care for this baby, but just do it out of the spirit of, like, love and trust in the work of God and just doing your best. And that's exactly what she did because I honestly wouldn't be the woman I am today without her and her guidance.
That's a beautiful testimony to her. I believe the little one's in charge right now.
Yes.
And that's fine.
I lived in the Bronx in New York until about the age of 13. And I ended up moving to Virginia after my mom remarried and divorced my adopted dad, who's actually my uncle. Because my biological mom is his sister. And at the time, it's very interesting. and at the time, you know, raised during the crack epidemic, drugs was definitely prevalent in my biological mom's life. She had her own trauma that she had to go through, not even learning about her HIV status until after my birth. Or 2 years after my birth, and had to learn that in a different way than what you know, I learned, or how doctors was able to, you know, let my family know that I was living with HIV and me receiving an immediate type of care versus her still dealing with not knowing for another 2 years until after that. So, and she just, we just reconnected recently, like in a really meaningful way. So she is able to like share some of this insight with me that has really supported me in my trauma and things that I was battling internally around my HIV status. So when I tell you it's been a journey, it's been a journey, a very thick journey of like isolation and feeling alone and feeling like there's nobody else out there born with HIV, not meeting my first person living with or born with HIV until I was 24 years old. Or 26 years old, and she was 28 years old, and we ended up being the first people to ever meet each other born with HIV. So that just tells you how isolated our community, as like, as we call ourselves dandelions or lifetime survivors of HIV, is truly, we are. You know, I didn't have the opportunity to go to camp, like you may hear in a lot of people's stories that they went to camp as children. They were able to meet other people born with HIV without even knowing that they were living with HIV at the time. But they just was able to enjoy the atmosphere of being around other kids and later in life finding out why they were all together. I never had that opportunity. I desperately wanted it, but I never got it until I was in my adult years. So HIV has always been a long-kept secret of mine, one of the biggest secrets. So you have to be... like, we had to be ace blooms for me to tell you that I was living with HIV. And even then, my mama was like, and still don't tell them because you still can't trust anybody. So it took a very, very long time before I disclosed my HIV status to anybody, yet alone meeting somebody who was like-minded, who shared my experiences, and understood exactly what I was feeling and what I was going through.
So, Antoinette, as your mother was telling you not to share your condition or your situation, your diagnosis with others, was that out of regard that people would shun you, disrespect you, bully you, or was she not sure how people were going to treat you?
Was
going to
receive it. Oh, yeah. Oh, we already know how kids can be very cruel, right? Like, just without even thinking about an HIV diagnosis. When you think about middle school, high school, grade school, kids are cruel. Kids don't bully you, whether it's for your skin complexion, whether it's because you have a gap in your teeth, whether it's because you're too short, too tall, kids are going to bully you. So just having additional thing that was so stigmatized in the 90s, in the early 2000s, especially in the 80s, but definitely in the 90s and early 2000s for me, it was more so like it was her way of protecting me. So she shared with me that I was living with HIV when I was 9 years old, and she had to share it at the time because her and my dad, who I call dad, was in an abusive situation. And the family, his side of the family was trying to gear up to like tell me who my real mom is and all this, and that I was living with HIV and all this news that she didn't want them to bombard me with. Emotions were heightened. People were angry. You know, it was just a bad time in my life. So she definitely, and I would always ask, like, why am I taking this medicine? Like, what is this for? What is going on in my life? Like, I was a very curious child, and I wanted to know. And finally, she just felt like she needed to tell me, because if she didn't tell me, she felt like somebody else was going to tell me. Mm-hmm. And that's not what she wanted. So
she ended up
telling me at 9. Time was when it was like a major light switch went off, and not in a good way. It was like as if realization had happened, Okay, baby. Realization took place. I had had to accept something that I kind of already knew, because, you know, people in the family, they talk, they whisper, they do certain things, like don't eat off of this spoon or don't do that.
Yeah.
So I kind of knew something was wrong with me. My mom used to always tell me before telling me my diagnosis, oh, like, you just have your immune system is just very compromised, or things like you just get sick very easily. You don't have a strong enough immune system, so this medicine helps build that up. But finally, she just had to tell me the truth. And from there, I hated HIV. I hated everything about it. I hate it. And hate is a very strong word. I don't use this word, but that's exactly at the age of 9 how I felt about HIV. I hated it. Hated the medicine, hated the diagnosis, hated the person who gave me HIV. I hated everything related to HIV. I hated going to the doc. I didn't care about the stickers that they gave anymore. I didn't care about the toys that they gave. I didn't care about nothing. I just hated it so much. And from there, my health just completely took a turn. I just stopped caring. And my mom had to, she had to become even more strong in order for me to feel a little bit more like weak and sad and angry. Because like, not only did she have to tell me that I had HIV, she had to tell me that her and my dad was getting divorced. Our family is moving apart. Like, there was just so much happening in a child's life at 9 years old that, you know, I don't think I was ready to handle at that time.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot, even for a grown person, you know? Wow.
Right. Right. So from there, I would either take my medicine. My mom would have to watch me with a microscope with this medicine.
Right.
I wouldn't take it. I would throw it out. I would sneak and put it underneath my tongue and then go to the bathroom and spit it out. I'll swallow it and then make myself throw it up. Like, I was just doing crazy stuff. Now that I look back on it, it's crazy, but I was just doing stuff because I was like, I don't care. I don't want to even acknowledge HIV.
And
in addition, and when she told me that about my diagnosis, that's when she told me, like, people can be mean. And you don't want to go to school and say that you have this condition, that you have this, that you're living with HIV, because people will bully you. People will make you feel different. And I think for her, she wanted me to feel as normal, as human as possible. So she was just like, just keep it a secret. Like, don't tell nobody. She was like, the only people who need to know is me, you, your sister, and your doctor. Like, nobody needs to know. And then she said, even if you really think that they're your best friend, they're your ace boon, that's what she always would say, they would not, they really not. And anybody can use anything that you tell them against you. So don't tell nobody. So from there, up until I was probably like teen, where I had to tell somebody I was in a relationship with, and then around like 17, 18, I had to tell a good friend of mine, only because I was living with them at the time. I didn't tell nobody. It was definitely a close-kept secret of mine.
I mean, I understand why your mom would have told you that, and then plus you had everything else going on with your mom and dad breaking up and relocating and all of like that. It made sense, you know, looking at it now from an adult point of view, but I'm sure that was quite traumatic for you, being 9 years old, to have to contend with all of those issues at the same time.
Very traumatic, very. I think about it now, and I'm just like, I have to do the healing work from all of that trauma. It was great advice. You know, it was the only advice that my mom knew to give me at the time. But it also, I never learned how to disclose my status when intimate. And we can talk about that later. But when intimate with partners, or when I'm meeting new people and want to be in new relationships, I didn't, all of that was new to me when I moved to Georgia. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know I would, how hard it would be to tell somebody that I'm living with HIV until I started to reflect on the fact that I was like, oh, it's because it's a secret. It's something that you are not supposed to tell people. That's what you were taught.
Right.
But it was, yeah, so that's when it showed up for me as like, dang, I just wish I had somebody like when I was younger. But I also am very grateful for it because I went to school in very different environments. In New York, very like multicultural type of schooling, you know. People are mean in New York, like that's just the culture. People are very aggressive in New York. So you wouldn't have known what to expect if your status got out, or if somebody learned about your HIV status, I would have definitely been bullied. When I moved to Virginia, because I moved to Virginia at the age of like 13 years old, and I had decent care in Virginia. I went to Children's Hospital, and then I also was able to go out of Children's and experience my first type of woman care at the age of 18, which was very different from children's care. Trust me, it was very different. It was very, like, not holding your hand throughout the process. Oh, you got it, you're on your own. And that was a reality check for me. I wasn't expecting that at all. But growing up in middle school and high school in Virginia, it was very, you either black or you white or you mixed, right? And you either got to fit into one of these two bubbles. It was very like, this is the image of what beauty looks like. This is like what perfection looks like. Like they, it felt like there were standards to certain things when I lived in Virginia. So I was definitely not sharing my HIV status because that was the age where it was like, oh, I got to be perfect, and I'm in high school, and now there's boys, and there's girls, and there's friends, and yeah, no, nobody is, I can't tell anybody.
Right.
I can't tell.
Yeah.
And I know that for sure that I desperately, desperately searched for community. Like, that was something that I always thought about, something that I always wanted. And that was, like, my main reason. One of my main reasons for moving to Georgia. I always wanted to go to Georgia, and I always knew that they called Georgia, like, the Black Mecca, or there was a large LGBTQ population out here in Georgia. I always knew that the HIV rates were higher in Georgia, so I put two and two together. I was like, when I turn 18, I'm going to Georgia. I'm going to GSU. I'm going to meet all these people living with HIV. I'm going to find my community. I just knew it.
Wow.
But I didn't move out here until I was 22 years old, and I ended up finding community. It took a little bit, but because of my mom, I needed a support group. And I was out here for at least a year and a half, very depressed, through a lot. My health was in a decline, and my mom just kept saying, go to this place. She kept sending me this one place for a support group. Go here. Like, they specifically work with black women. You should go here. And I'm like, no, Ma, I don't need a support group. I'm fine. I'm going to get through. I'm going to get through. And then finally, that same place that she sent me, I saw that they were hiring one day, and I needed a job. So I went in there, and they asked me, like, why do I think I would be perfect for this position? And I told them, because I'm living with HIV. Like, why else wouldn't I be perfect for the position? With all the confidence in the world. And what was crazy is I had never openly said I'm living with HIV so confidently and so boldly to a room of people in my life. And that's what I think got me the job. I didn't have that confidence before that day, but I went in there. I was like, because I'm living with HIV. Why else? And it was like, we're going to give her the job. And it wasn't the job I actually applied for. They actually created that peer specialer, that youth peer specialist position for me.
Wow.
Because they saw a need in community, and they saw that I could fit the need.
That's beautiful. And your body was just busting, wanting to announce, make that announcement out loud to somebody all the time.
It felt so liberating. It felt so liberating to say I left there and I boohoo cried. And my mom was just like, I told you, I've been telling you to go there. And I was like, I know, but girl, now I'm desperate. So I really need to go. But I boohoo cried because I just felt the shift. I'm a very, very spiritual person. So I just felt the shift after that day, and I just knew from there that my life was not going to be the same.
Awesome.
And that was 6 years ago in 2018.
Wow, that wasn't that long ago, was it?
Nope, not at all.
So you briefly touched on boyfriends or, you know, that whole dating part of as a teenager. Did you date while you were in Virginia, or were you just pretty much to yourself to handle that?
Yes, so I dated. I had a few little crushes here and there. You know, I'm all for pleasure and sex activism. That's a part of the work that I do. So in all honesty, I was doing a little things here and there, a little touchy-feely stuff, nothing too extreme because I was so I was so scared. So I would let people touch me down there, but it wouldn't go further than that. And then I ended up having a girlfriend, actually. I thought having a girlfriend was safe for me because that was the only way that I saw was the least or the most, the least way to transmit HIV was through girl-on-girl contact. So I was like,
right,
oh,
right.
Yeah. I always liked women and I always liked girls, but I was like, oh, no, I'm going to be with a woman. During this time of high school when sex is, like, heightened, I don't want situation. Nope. So I just felt like it was safe for me to be with a woman at that time. And I actually stayed with that girl for at least 5 years.
Wow.
So I didn't, as they say, pop my virginity until I was 18 years old. And that was actually that was a commitment to myself that I made. And an honor to my mom. Like, we had an agreement. Your body is a temple. Just honor it until you fully understand your body. And I'm glad I waited until I was 18 because I didn't understand my body. I didn't understand the ins and outs of HIV the way that I know I needed to. I didn't know how to disclose. I didn't know how to tell someone I was living with HIV. So even when I told her, at the age of like 16 or 17, she did not take it well. Like, I had all the information lined up. Like, you know, there's almost 0% of transmission with girls. But because stigma was so bad, the girl ended up fainting. She was so scared. Like, she, because we were intimate in, you know, ways that women can be. And she was just so scared. And but that was the first time that I heard somebody say something like, okay, I'm going to go get tested. You know, I've never heard that before until that interaction. And we ended up breaking up for a little bit. What was that?
How did that make you feel? How did that make you feel when she said she was going to get tested?
Oh, the testing part was kind of like a relief. I was like, okay, good, go get tested, you know. But the fainting and everything else that came along with it, the anger that she had, it made me very insecure. I was already battling things around depression and different things like that, but the stigmatizing things that came up during that time definitely had an impact on me. And on top of what I was already feeling around HIV, so to hear somebody else, like, that I was in love with at the time tell me, like, how could you do this to me? I could die. I'm about to die. And I'm just like, but Google says that women can't transmit it to women, or there's not a high risk of transmitting it to women. So I thought I was safe. But when she was like, I'm going to go get tested, and then she did, and then it came back negative, I was like, whew, thank you, God. Like, because I was so nervous and afraid during that time. And I had to, I was like, but when I wanted love, let's be very real. When you are that age and you are living with this diagnosis, you question if you will ever be loved by somebody, if you will ever feel love. And then the second that you do have love and you are intimate with somebody, you don't want to lose it. So once we told Whirlwind of, like, okay, you're not positive, I am, this is what we're going to do to protect ourselves, she was able to get dental dams from her, from the place that she went to go get tested at. And we gave those a try. We used those for a little bit. But then after a while, I was like, baby, we ain't, come on now. Like, let's listen to Google. she felt safe and I felt safe. And we would have conversations about my medication. We would have conversations about how I was feeling around meds, if I was taking them, if I was undetectable. She never came to any of my appointments, but she would ask about them. And I would tell her, like, yep, I'm still undetectable. I was taking my medicine at that time faithfully because I was still at Children's Hospital. So I was still going to the doctor with my mom. I was still doing a lot of things that didn't take my that I needed to do in order to be, quote-unquote, healthy. But after that, baby, it's a long story, but once I turned 18, I aged out of pediatric care. Now they changed the age, and a lot of people growing with HIV went through this experience where we age out. And they, at some clinics, some folks will have transitionary clinics. Like, so you'll stay at the same hospital, you'll just go to another area of the hospital for adult care. With me, because I went to Children's Hospital and their age out was 18, I have to go find a whole new clinic to go to.
And you had to go and find it?
My family, yeah, they didn't find it for us. Like, my family had to do the research, and we had to go find a HIV care clinic for adults. And we lived in Virginia. Children's Hospital was in D.C., so I went to Children's Hospital from the age of 14 to 18, driving back and forth to D.C. every 3 months with my mom. So once I got into adult care and we found a clinic, it's called iNova. I can't remember the exact name, but that was the first time I ever experienced, like, adult care as far as, one, you got to schedule your own appointment. My mom was like, I'm sorry, you got to call them yourself. You 18 now. It's an adult clinic. I can't call for you. So she sat there with me, but I had to call them myself. My mama can't go with me anymore. I got to go to the doctor by myself now. After her going with me for 18 years, now you want me to go alone? So I had to go by myself. I had to pick up my prescriptions on my own. That was a whole whirlwind, making sure the prescriptions got dropped off. And the place where we had the clinic, it was so crazy, was right around the corner from my high school. And it was behind a post office. You would have never thought this was there. But once I started to go, I was like, wow, this is like damn near in the neighborhood. Like, I could see anybody around here. Anybody could see me. But I had to age quickly in the matter of, like, 2 months. It was like, oh, 18. I'm sorry, we can't see her no more. She got to go. And I had to age so quickly. And my mom was like, you have to learn to do this on your own because I can't do this. Like, I can't hold your hand throughout this process forever. And I had realized my mom sits here. We take our medicine together. She's always, because I've always had issues with adherence and taking my medicine. So we would have a routine. But once I was in that adult care and doing everything and having to do everything on my own, she was like, no, you got to do this. Like, even down to you making sure you take your medicine regularly. And that was challenging for me. And I started to decline. Like, I wasn't mommy's baby no more. I didn't have her holding my hand. And my health definitely took an impact because it just all hit me at once. It was scary.
Because you weren't getting that attention.
But I learned about, I wasn't getting that attention, and I was a woman. It was a pap smear? You're 18 now. Have you ever had a pap? I was like, a pap smear? What is that? What are you trying to do? And even, like, I'm telling you, my mom talked to me and my sister about everything. Everything sexual transmission, everything down to what a blue waffle was. Like, she would show us pictures. And I'm just like, that she just didn't know to share with us, especially with me, that was, you know, connected to my HIV care. Because how would she know? life has been...
So the whole family had to grow in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Mainly my mom. She did a lot of the bulk of the work. A lot of other folks within the family wasn't really involved in my care like that. It was just my mom and my sister. So going through... iNova Care really taught me about womaning in HIV. It taught me a little bit about mental health in HIV. Like, I didn't have a name for what depression was until I went to this iNova Care. And I actually saw a psychiatrist and saw a therapist for the first time in life. Like, that's when I was like, oh, that's what I've been feeling. Like, these thoughts I'm having about living and wanting to be here in the flesh and on earth, it's suicide? Oh, that's the name for it? Okay, thank you for that. About this feeling around HIV and this, like, feeling like it's a cloud over my head? What is that? Like, you know, they were a Black psychiatrist, therapist, and a Black nurse practitioner. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor will come in, like, once a year. You will only see the doctor once a year, but the nurse practitioner took care of you. So I was there for about 3 years with them, and they took care of me. But they probably dealt with a lot of my up and down as far as medication, as far as adherence, as far as, like, do you want to live? Okay, no, why not? Okay, we don't know what to, like, it was new for me, and I was sick for them as well, because I actually don't think that they had a lot of people born with HIV come through those clinic doors either.
Right. Ooh. Well, it sounds very challenging, but you grew so much that frame and matured and took some lessons that you learned to heart to make you a much stronger person as a result of that. But I can only imagine what that, because it's hard enough, you know, just coming up with no health issues, with, you know, nothing going against you at all, just, you know, out singing a song and going up and down the street, kind of, you know, but to actually to have the diagnosis and all of the mental wellness issues because I can see that very plainly too, because I believe that most of us do suffer from mental health issues, but because we can't put a name on it, you know, like it's because of this or it's because of that, it makes it real hard for us to accept or even go for any type of help. So you got a well-rounded experience from all of the doctor's visits and having to grow up immediately at age 18 and things like that. So I understand why you are the type of person that you are and willing, so willing to reach back and to help others. So thank you for having the compassion as you were learning all those skills to be able to help other people.
Of course, definitely, definitely. And we didn't have a name for it. Like you said, mental wellness is a great way to put it. I grew up in a Christian black household. Once I moved to Virginia, my mom remarried. And the go-to was, like every black person say, go pray about it. Go pray about it. I'm sad. I don't want to live. I don't want to be here anymore. I remember crying tears on tears. And my mom would be like, go pray about it. Like, go in your room and pray. You will feel much better. Mm. And that didn't work.
Right.
Why isn't this working? Why do I not feel better the way that I need to feel better, where I don't have these intrusive thoughts anymore, these overwhelming feelings of not feeling valuable enough? And it took me sitting with that therapist at the age of 18, 19 years old and actually putting a name to it. And all she asked me was, how do you feel about your HIV? Like, when you think about your HIV and you could describe it with a picture, how would you describe it? And the way I described it was a black cloud, like following me everywhere I go. I couldn't get rid of it. I couldn't run from it. Every time I turned around, it was right there. And from there, you know, she didn't diagnose me with depression, but she was like, I think you are experiencing a form of depression. And I think you have been experiencing this for a very long time, and it's just gone unaddressed and unnoticed for a very long time. And just thinking about that, as I moved to Georgia, thinking about that, the isolation I was feeling, all of the things that I've gone through from the age of 9 and up, I was like, oh, there are other kids out there born with HIV. There's youth out there. There are people out there who are going through the same thing that I'm going through. Like, I just knew I wasn't alone. The same way,
right,
I knew I wasn't alone when it was like, oh, I'm going to find me another person born with HIV, and I found my sister in change. I knew I was going to find, I was like, I got to do this work for other people. Because I would refuse to want anybody to go through what I was going through. Like, it just turmoil at one point. Me and my friend was just talking earlier about, she was mentioning the time when I was, like, on her couch. And, like, she was like, your face was so pale. You was unrecognizable. And I remember at that time, because my medicine wasn't working the way it was supposed to, I was really sick. I didn't feel sick. I didn't know I was sick, but she could see it all over my face. And that was also a way that my mom would describe when I was sick. My mom was like, you ain't take your medicine in a while. Like, she could look at me. She could see the boniness in my structure. She could see, like, my under eyes. She could see it from being around me. Before I could even see it, or before I would even admit that I wasn't taking my medicine at one point in time or 3 points in time. And that was the same thing that my friend and I was talking about earlier. She was like, I was so worried, but I didn't know how to tell you I was worried because, you know, we were newly friends, probably like a year in, and she didn't know a lot about HIV. So she was like, but now that, you know, we've talked more, we've been friends for 5+ years. She was like, oh, yeah, I know when you ain't doing well. But I've been doing, so she's happy. But moving to Georgia, honestly, was like probably one of the best things that I could have done, not at the beginning, but reflecting on it, it's like one of the best things I could have done as far as for my health, for my my mental health and finding community, for everything, even having a baby, my baby being a Grady baby, like for my confidence, for my mood, for my attitude, Georgia was definitely one of the best moves that I probably could have done to really change just who I am.
Talk to us about the baby. who has been so wonderful tonight. It appears that she's allowing you to do this interview with no disruptions from her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so my baby is 2 years old now. She is a summer baby. And she was probably manifested, I would say, when I was 18 and in adult care in Virginia. Like, I always knew I wanted to have a baby, even before that.
Huh?
I always knew I wanted to have a baby because I told myself that I would have a child not living with HIV. And, like, I would just shift what I believe to be a generational curse. Like, I was just like, nope, that's not going to happen in my story. And I'm going to have a baby. She's going to be negative. And even at that time, I said, I'm going to breastfeed my baby. Watch. I would do all types of, like, Google for millennials was the best thing to ever be invented. Because I would research all this stuff. I would look this stuff up and be like, can women breastfeed if they're living with HIV? Can people breastfeed? And it would say no. And I would be like, you know what? I'm a breastfeed. Watch me. Like, I was... people would call it a bad child or combative or whatever, but I was just that person where I just had to defy the odds. And once I got pregnant with her, and I want to honor Hermione Bell in this moment because, and there's so many people I want to honor today. Hermione is one of them. Hermione was my provider, another Black woman who really saved my life when it came to HIV.
Yes.
Because when I tell you, when my friend said you were very sick and I could just see it all over your face, it was because before I met Hermione, I was at a clinic that mostly seen males. They mostly seen men. They had a few female clients, but not enough to really understand how HIV impacted women. And the doctor that I had specialized with men. So I moved to Georgia on a regimen. I was taking Stribild and something else. I literally was trying to remember what medications last night. Stribild and something else. I was taking those medicines for probably before I moved to Virginia for like the past 5 years before I moved to Georgia. And he took me off of the additional medicine and kept me on Stribild. And he was like, nobody's in Georgia taking this combination anymore. You don't need this combination. You just need Stribild. Because you're undetectable. And that was the one thing that those doctors in Virginia made sure about. I was undetectable. I was up and down, but they was like, before you go to Georgia, you're going to be undetectable, girl. And I was. And when I got to him, he was like, oh, you're undetectable. You don't need that second pill no more. You just going to take Stribild. Everybody in Georgia is on one of those. I was celebrating because I'd never been on a one-a-day pill. I've always taken three or more medications in my lifetime. So when he took me off of the additional medicine, I was like, yes, God, this is a blessing. And I was celebrating. And I didn't realize, like, every time I would go back to the doctor after that, my HIV would increase. My viral load would increase. It wasn't doing well. I wasn't undetectable after about 6 months. It was just, it wasn't doing great. And
wow.
He couldn't. And his reasoning was he would blame me, as a Black woman. He would say, "You're not taking your medicine, or is there something wrong with the meds? Are you taking it every day like you're supposed to?" And I would tell him, "I am taking the medicine. I am. I'm doing what I'm supposed to. I may not take it every day, but I take this goddamn medicine, okay?" But there were times when I would take it consistently, it was so frustrating because I'm like, I know I'm taking this medicine and my numbers are not coming back the way it's supposed to. So finally I decided it was time for me to leave that doctor. I was like, you know what, he's not listening to me. There's just something off about this. So I left. And I ended up going to another clinic. And they drew my labs at an intake. They just drew my labs, and they was like, okay, we'll call you with your actual appointment and who your provider will be. And I went back to the clinic for a support group, and next thing you know, they were pulling me out of the support group. Somebody, a nurse, came, and they got me, and they was like, can you come with me? Somebody wants to talk to you. And then they put me in a room with this black woman who is Hermione Bell, who's a nurse practitioner, who was a nurse practitioner. And she transitioned on February 21st. And Hermione looked at me, and she said, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. And she was like, your numbers, they didn't come back okay. And she mentioned my my viral load being through the roof, and my hemoglobin was at a 6. So, like, I was at risk for a blood transfusion. And she was she just kept looking at me. And then she was like, holding my hands because they were so pale. And she was like, are you sure you're okay? Like, do you feel lightheaded? And she was just looking at my eyes, making sure I was okay. And I was like, oh, I feel fine. I feel good. So then she asked me, like, tell me all the medicines that you remember taking in all your life, like even up until you moved to Georgia. And I told her the combination that I was on before the doctor took me off of that pill. And she was like, that's why you're sick, and that's why your viral load is going up. She said that combination that you were on while you were in Virginia was specific to your resistance. He wasn't supposed to take you off of that combination. And it took a black woman to not even, like, it took a black woman to ask that question, but also to not accuse me of not doing something that I was supposed to, and to, like, hear me.
Yeah.
So I get emotional thinking about it, but I will forever love Hermione for that. Because she saved my life. Like,
yeah.
And she was immediately like, nope, we're taking you off of Stribill. You're not doing that no more. We're going to put you on this medicine. And take this medicine for the next 2 weeks, and I guarantee you're going to be feeling better. And that's what I did. I listened to that black woman because she reminded me of my mama. Hey, ma'am. I was back to undetectable. And then Hermione said, at our next couple of visits, she said, you want to have a baby? You ever think about having a baby? And I was like, yeah, one day, and we were going into COVID at this time. It was like 2020, 2021. So the whole state was going on lockdown. So our in-person visits had transitioned to virtual visits. And I remember calling Hermione after I found out I was pregnant. And she was like, well, you know, I can't be your provider right now, but I will refer you to somebody who I know is going to take good care of you. And she also said, like, but if you need anything, you can always call me. If you have any questions or if they're not doing something right, just call me, and I will give you the best advice to my knowledge. And I sure did call her. Like, after being with her for 2.5 years, that was my go-to. So when it came down to breastfeeding and wanting to breastfeed and me going back and forth with the OBGYN clinic about breastfeeding and them changing my medicine and putting me on these horse pills when they know that I have adherence issues, like, I was like, Hermione, what you want me to do? Like, what should I say? How should I advocate for myself in this moment? And she was like, talk to them about the promise study. You can do this. Just do this and do, or ask for this medicine. Ask them why they're not putting you on this instead. If that pill is too big. She just knew herself. She knew her research, and she was very supportive in my journey. So that's how, you know, it came from that one little question of, you think you want to have a baby? And I always wanted to have a baby. I just never had a doctor ask me if I wanted to have a baby. And Hermione did, so I felt seen. I felt like it was a possibility, like a real possibility of somebody actually believed in me having a baby. And who was, a year later, I was pregnant. I was like, and she the first person I called. I was like, okay, now, what am I supposed to do? And she guided me in the best way she could. So, and I am proud to say that I breastfed my baby. I'm proud to say that, you know, me and a few other advocates changed the guidelines around breast and chest feeding for women living with HIV and people who are living with HIV. And the reason I say women and people is because transgender men can also breastfeed. So, and they call it chest feeding. So I like to recognize all people when I speak and be very inclusive with my language. I know it's National Women and Girls Day, but I just, I'm a very inclusive person and I recognize people in all identities. So, but shout out to those folks. And she's very healthy, overly healthy sometimes. I'm surprised she's this quiet. She probably thinks I'm just over here chatting on the phone with one of my sisters. She's a beautiful spirit. I don't know where I would be without my baby. She's definitely a blessing.
Ooh, but this has been quite and a glimpse into your life to hear and to actually feel, because I know I was feeling what you were talking about and the various situations that you had to contend with in this medical healthcare system that we contend with on a day in and day out basis that don't always have people's rights at heart. And then you put that on top of something else, and it's like they struggle to really provide a top-notch experience for us. And so when you meet a Hermione Bell and you have that experience, it's kind of hard for you to go somewhere else and get an inferior type of service compared to what the type of attention and passion that she would serve you with. So I'm glad you had that, and I'm glad you had it early in life and that it also helped to produce your daughter. That's really a home run right there. So tell us about your Dandelion Inc. and Dandelion Movement, please.
Yes. So it's not mine. Let me start by saying that I am a co-founder, and I wouldn't have been able to produce this without the support of Dorothea Williams, who's a co-founder. She's also my fellow co-executive director. Without the support of Tiffany Marrero, who is no longer on this earth with us. She transitioned last year in 2023. She is also a Dandelion, and we honor her as a co-founder. But most importantly, without the vision and the visionary ideas, the insight, just seeing far beyond their own years, Mary Bowman, who actually wrote the poem Dandelions. And that poem really encompasses the experiences of us as people who were born with HIV or diagnosed in early childhood, lifetime survivors. We don't know nothing else but this life of living with HIV, as well as the experiences of our mothers who passed the virus to us in utero or through birth. And she also has a line in there that talks about roses. And sometimes that's our community, our adopted community, the people who raised us. So our life is really encompassed in that poem. And me and Dorinthia, that was who I named as the first person I met when I was 26 years old and she was 28. We didn't meet anybody else living with HIV. And I can name her because she is out with her status. She's known in the community, but she is the person born with HIV like myself. Our stories are very much so aligned, and God purposely aligned it that way because he had a vision for us that we could not see. We met in 2018. We both was like, yo, there got to be some more of us out there. Like, you're my first person that I met, And I can't believe it took all these years for me to meet somebody. Can we find other people? Can we find people like us? And with that mindset, we knew that we had to create something where we will be able to find something that's for us. So at first we started in 2018. We wanted to just have a retreat. We wanted to have a conference. We wanted to have something that was just like bringing our community together. That was our goal at the time. And we set and we had different names we were throwing out there, things like the Forgotten About Community, because that's one thing that we name as something within people who are born with HIV. We are often forgotten about in the conversation around HIV and women, HIV and men. Like people, they talk about sexually transmitted. They talk about drug users, but they don't talk about the children. And we was like, okay, we're the forgotten about community. But that just didn't stick the way that it needed to stick. And then we said something else, and that didn't stick. And then there was one day, I think it was like 2022, I had had my baby. Me and Dee had, our lives just drew us apart for a little bit, but then we came back together after I had my baby. And we just sit in my room one day, and this is after Mary Bowman had transitioned in 2019. And like I said, we honor her and her visionary for why we named it this. And we sit in the room, and I was like, we should name it Dandelions. And Dee was like, okay. And I said, no. I said, it's Dandelions. And I was like, Dee, because she was heading out. She was about to leave. I said, when you get in your car, I want you to play the Dandelions poem and blast it, like as loud as you can play it. And I said, I'm going to be in here. I was in my house. And I said, I'm going to play it as loud as I can play it on my speaker in my house. When I tell you I can hear Dorinthia playing that Dandelions from her car inside my house and my doors and windows were shut, the girl she played it as loud as she could. And then after she was riding away, and then after both of ours finished, we ended up calling each other, and we were boohoo crying because it was a spirit that came over us, and we just knew that was it. Like, we just knew that we could not have name this movement anything else but Dandelions. It was as if Mary was giving us the green light to go ahead and do it. That it would be okay, and it was in the right purpose in the right time, and we did it. We did it with the support of so many different community members. One being Masanya, she believed in us, she worked with us, and she pushed us. And so many others, but it just, and then, you know, we connected with Tiffany, and the way that we connected with Tiffany Morrell, it was towards the end of her life after receiving a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. And we supported her, but she believed in Dandelions. Like, she loved Mary, and she was like, okay, what are we doing here? I'm excited. I want to bring our community together too. And it was as if the process to grow Dandelions was overpowering the pain that she was feeling with cancer.
Wow.
And that was what she needed during that time.
Sure.
And we needed her. Yeah, we needed her more than she knew. So it was a good balance for all of us. So losing Tiffany last year was definitely very hard, but we honor her as a co-founder because she contributed so much in the last month, in the last year, honestly, of her life. So much down to, like, our bylaws and just working with us on the foundational pieces of what an organization is. She is so knowledgeable. If you look up Tiffany Morrell and the work that she did, that girl was so, she knew her ish to the point where she would go into spaces, she would demand our rights, she would call people out, from federal folks to folks at the CDC to folks at folks who were writing our grants. Like, she knew her ish, and she was like, I'm going to do everything I can do to make sure dandelions pop before I leave this earth, and she sure enough
awesome.
Did. So we wouldn't have been able to do it without her, and I got to name her in this space. So now we are just like building our community, building our network. So the difference between Dandelions Inc. and the movement is Dandelions Inc. is just the nonprofit name. Like that's just how we that's just how we register, okay?
Sure.
The movement is really the community. It's why we push, why we do this work, how we bring our people together, how we demand what we need, our rights. Inclusion in spaces, how we demand respect. A lot of people see us as babies. So when you think of people born with HIV and those diagnosed in early childhood, they're like, oh, those little babies. Y'all was babies while we got diagnosed. And y'all was little kids. And I knew you when you was this age. And that's how a lot of the community has looked at us over the years. People remember Hadia as that five-year-old little girl, and they would never probably get that out of her head without realizing she was a 39-year-old beautiful woman.
Exactly.
And that's pretty much what we're trying to get the world to see. Like, we've been here. That's our chant. We are here, and we've been here long before a lot of folks became diagnosed. The first child to be diagnosed was in 1987 or 1978. I get the numbers confused, but we was here at the start of the epidemic with everybody else.
Yeah.
And it's our time to be recognized for that. So we are working. We are coming together. That's our main point. Like, how do we bring our community together? Because a lot of us never have that experience of being together.
Exactly.
And a lot of folks may have either seen us for the first time or seen us together for the first time at this past USCHA where we took the stage. We played Mary's poem. If folks haven't heard that Dandelion's poem, go watch it tonight. And you will see and you will hear why we are the movement that we are. Everything is literally written in that poem. And one line in that poem that she has that I absolutely love is, I will lay my life on the line if it means that dandelions or unseen scars would not be seen as odd but as gifts from God. And that's pretty much what I had to go through to see myself.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks in our community has to go through. Like,
I actually had the honor of hearing her say that poem here in Atlanta years back when I was working with Sister Love. So I'm familiar. She's a powerful, powerful individual. And look, we are down to about 8 or 9 minutes left in the show. And if anyone has a comment, question, need a point of clarification, whatever, now would be the time. Give me 1 second. We do have a caller. Opening up the line. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, Sandy. How are you?
Hey, Tammy. I'm doing great. How are you? I so appreciate you putting together this panel of people.
And I want to thank Antoinette for the beautiful story. And I was so glad that she accepted the invitation to be a part of this project, I Learned to Walk in the Rain. And my plans are with the two other ladies is to take it up a notch, and maybe hopefully we can travel with it, present it at USCHA. But I thank you so much, Antoinette, for bringing, and you as well, Sandy, for bringing Hermione and Hadia into this healthy conversation, into this space. I am so honored.
Yeah, they belong. Yes, yes.
Thank you, Miss Tammy, for the opportunity and just seeing me. I met Tammy when I worked at Sister Love, and I remember she was like, "You're so young." I was like, "I feel so old." and it was that I feel so old where she was just like, "Yeah, I get like she just seen me, because she just knew like even though she a baby, she had to be living with this for so long." And then when she saw us at USCHA, because she saw me and she met me in 2018 when I was a baby. Right, Miss Tammy? Like, I wasn't this
flower. That's right.
I wasn't this confident and this happiness and this esteemed in myself. So for her to see me from there till now, she was just so proud at USCHA last year.
So proud.
She told me that. And I love her for that.
That's cool. Yeah, you seasoned now.
Oh, yeah, she's very much seasoned. But
thank you, ladies, and thank you, Antoinette.
Thank you.
So we got one more caller I want to bring on. So, caller, go right ahead. Give us your name if you'd like and whatever your question, comment, or concern is.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hi, this is Dorinthia. I have a question for Nettie. I would like to know, you stated that you was in a relationship with a woman and you was like there's a less possibility of transmission. Is that actually true or is it just something that you thought? I don't know if I caught that part or not.
Thank you, Dorinthia. No, that is actually true. I actually did all of that research when I was in a relationship with that woman. And I think, I can't remember the accurate numbers, but that's what gave me the confidence to even date somebody, a woman at the time, where I felt comfortable and I felt safe. I think it was like a less than 2% chance. Like, it was very, very low. And I was like, yeah, we good. So... and now they even have more research around the transmission between women. It's so low, it's barely even a possibility to transmit.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed listening to you tonight. You're absolutely amazing. And thank you for sharing.
Thank you for being my sister in pain.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we got one more caller here up the line. All right, caller, go right ahead. Give us your name, if you would like, and your comment, question, or concern, please.
Hey, my name is Eve, and I listen to the show, and I did more than listen to the show, and I'm probably, without a doubt, not first on this. What I'm going to say, but what I got to say is I'm going into your strength and your power, and it feels so, so dynamite and good. And I wanted to throw out there what you already know. I'm thinking about, are you a movie, a theater? I'm thinking about world events. I'm thinking about everything that you've been through is so huge, and wait a minute that we're going through. And you're waking us up as well as everybody else. And the way you're doing it, such a huge protection from your family to mine to the world. We want to see more of you and your actions and what you do. And I congratulate you and wait until you hear what I got to say to you. It's already on tape. I can repeat it for Sandy to tell you what I think, what we think. About you. A lot of love and wow, the best of the best of the best. Eve, and I'm going to stick to that, and we care and we love you.
Thank you, Eve.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, Tammy just told us she's taking it on the road, and I trust Tammy to do what she says she's going to do. So, You may get your wish, Eve, and you'll see this on the big screen.
Oh, wow. You know what? She's going to know it's me. Love you all. Love you. Thank you.
Love you, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And, yeah, this is the part of life that we really don't share and communicate with each other. You know, so it's to have this type of a honest, friendly, family type of conversation with you ladies that have showed up and willingly come to talk about something that's happening in our community that we turn a blind eye to is just awesome. So I appreciate you more than I could ever tell you, being able to break it down in plain, loving English where people can understand the exact day-to-day happenings that you're dealing with. And so I thank you again. I thank you again. If you want to give people contact information for you, social media handle, whatever, that would be great. Let me just say this real quick before we get to that. On March the 12th, which is the second Tuesday, so it's not next week, it's 2 weeks from today, we're going to have Tammy, Sharita, and Antoinette do a three-person panel, and they're going to bring together various viewpoints around women, girls, and HIV/AIDS awareness. So make sure you put that on your calendar and come back. You can come back next week, too, but I just want to make sure that you come back for our session, this series, I Learned to Walk in the Rain, which has just absolutely been marvelous. And Tammy, thank you for your brilliance and your creativeness in putting this panel of women together. It has been absolutely incredible. So right now I'm going to turn the microphone over to Antoinette, let you close us out. Tell us, give us some words to live by.
Yes, thank you. So one thing I do want to do is correct. I accidentally said the line in the poem wrong, and I want folks to really hear these words. So it goes, I would gladly, and Mary probably did not know what she was writing at the time when she created this poem, but she created a whole movement by creating this poem.
Yeah.
So it says, I would gladly give myself as a sacrifice if it means that dandelions in the world will be viewed as much more than consequences of sins behind closed doors. You can lay me on my back and present me lifeless to God if it means that dandelions with unseen scars would not be viewed as odd but as gifts from God. So I wanted to say the whole line so people can really feel what was manifested way before I even knew that I wanted to fill these shoes. Me and Dorinthia and many other people in the community, we're just tying them and we're just running the race, y'all. We just running until we see the finish line for our community, and so that they don't have to feel what we feel or we had to feel anymore. So I just wanted to leave y'all with that, but my social media, in order to connect with the Dandelions Movement, you can definitely reach out to thedandelionsmovement@gmail.com or visit our website, thedandelions.org. And if you want to connect with myself, you can find me at itsTheAntoinette on Instagram, Antoinette Jones on Facebook, as well as my other brand, which is called Sunday Tea, where I do a lot of my holistic wellness around Black liberation, Black queendom, Black tea, just different things like that about just celebrating all of your Blackness, because I love being Black. Black History Month, and we're going to celebrate that all year long. So yep, thank you again, Miss Sandy. It was an honor to share space with you and to have this privilege to share my story and to uplift the stories of many others. So I appreciate you for that. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. And thank you. I applaud you. I applaud you for having the courage, the maturity, and the willingness to come and to share your story so honestly and fully, sincerely, I appreciate you. But we'll see you guys back in 2 weeks. So, Tammy, thank you. And we'll see you guys next week, same time. We have the first Tuesday next week with our numerologist, Brother Lavelle Rouser. So if you're into that, come and take a listen to what advice he's going to give us. Otherwise, we'll see you in 2 weeks when we bring the full group back. All right. Love you guys. Take care. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, yes, yes. Bye.